You are listening to All the Quiet Witnesses, written by Hachigo, read by Princess Moonlight. Chapter 6, Hot Dog Vendor. Rufus felt like he had been running this food cart longer than most people had been alive. The city changed around him. Buildings went up. Teams won and lost. Faces blurred into new ones. But his corner of the city stayed good. Late nights, hungry people, quiet conversations that didn't need an audience. That suited him just fine. He didn't care much for hockey. He knew enough, obviously. You lived in Boston. You absorbed it whether you wanted to or not. Jerseys everywhere. Voices rising and falling with the season. He could name the captain. Knew when the team was on a winning streak. And knew when not to bring it up. But fame never impressed him. Manners did. Which was why he liked Ilya. The kid came around late, usually after the bars thinned out. Never loud, never rude. Always said please. Always said thanks. Sometimes stayed to eat right there, leaning against the cart while they talked about nothing in particular. Weather, traffic, whether the onions looked any good that night in his hot dog. Sometimes it felt like Ilya needed the quiet. So when he showed up one night and said, "Two hot dogs, please," Rufus noticed. Didn't comment, just nodded and got to work. He handed them over and watched Ilya count out the money, smile distracted, eyes already flicking across the street. The park was empty except for one bench and one man sitting on it. Young, dark-haired, hands shoved into his jacket pockets like he wasn't sure what to do with them. Ilya crossed the street without hesitation. Rufus pretended not to watch, but of course he did. Ilya handed over one hot dog like it was an offering. The other man laughed, said something that made Ilya grin wide and unguarded. They sat shoulder to shoulder on the bench, knees touching, talking with their mouths full like they had forgotten where they were. They leaned in close, not dramatic, not secretive, just natural. Rufus felt something settle in his chest. About time. He had seen Ilya alone too often, had noticed the way the kid lingered longer some nights, like he didn't want to go back to an empty place. People like that didn't need advice. They needed company. After a while, Ilya came back with the wrappers, tossing them into the trash beside the cart. Rufus raised an eyebrow. "Didn't know you shared." Ilya startled, blushed like he had been caught stealing.
Yeah, he said, rubbing the back of his neck. "Friends visiting."
Rufus snorted. "Good to see you with someone else, for once." Ilya laughed, quietly and embarrassed.
"He is good."
"That's what matters," he answered. Ilya looked surprised at that, then relieved, mumbled something that might have been a thank you or a good night. Rufus smiled to himself as the kid hurried back to the park, to this man. When he closed up for the night, the park was empty again, just the bench, just the street light. He locked the cart and headed home. Tomorrow night, he'd be there again. Then the nights after. Maybe the kid will come back for 2 hot dogs again. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7. Park Bench Lady. Sleep was an unreliable companion for Dorothy. It came and went as it pleased, never staying as long as she wanted. Some nights it abandoned her entirely, leaving her staring at the ceiling, counting the hours until morning felt reasonable. It had been like that since her husband passed away 7 years ago. On those days, she went to the park. She dressed quietly, wrapped herself in a cardigan no matter the season, and took the familiar path down the street while the city of Ottawa still felt half asleep. The ducks were always awake. They recognized her footsteps now, the soft rustle of the paper bag she carried. She liked that. It was good to be expected. The bench near the pond was hers, as much as anything could belong to someone in a public park. The wood was worn smooth in the places she sat, the view unchanged despite the years. She fed the ducks carefully, scattering just enough to keep them from fighting. Routine, she had learned, was a kindness. That was how she noticed the runners. 2 of them, not always together, but always early. The dark-haired one didn't come all the time, but it was becoming more frequent. When they are together, they come from the same direction, feet hitting the path in a steady rhythm. She didn't know their names, didn't need to. The blonde one ran with more energy, talking as he ran, hands cutting through the air. The other moved with more focus, more control, but always listening intensely to the other. They weren't young, not boys, men, she thought, in the middle of things. They go past her bench every time. Sometimes they ran, sometimes they walked. Once they arrived with coffee cups, steam curling into the cold air. They didn't always stop, but they always glanced her way, a small acknowledgement. She noticed things, the way the taller one reached for the other's sleeve when he laughed too hard, the way the dark-haired one slowed his pace instinctively, matching steps without looking, the way silence between them felt comfortable, weighted with understanding and love. They talked quietly, about nothing she could quite follow, about schedules and flights and places she had never been. As they walked away, shoulders touching, she watched them go with a soft smile. Today they began to slow nearby, stretching, catching their breath, laughing softly like they were sharing a joke the world didn't need to hear. She watched without staring. People were like birds that way. If you were still enough, they forgot you were there. But this morning, the taller one stopped entirely and looked up at the pond with open fascination.
"So many,"
he said, accent thick and warm. She smiled and held out the bag. "They're greedy, but harmless." Both men lit up at once. They approached like children given permission to play. The light-haired one crouched immediately, tossing feet with dramatic flair. The other one laughed, delighted when the duck surged forward in a flurry of feathers. She watched their joy settle into the space around them. They stayed longer than usual that day. They talked to the ducks, argued about which one was the boldest. The dark-haired man fed one duck by hand, holding still with reverent concentration while the other teased him mercilessly. When they finally stood to leave, both thanked her, polite, earnest,
See you tomorrow,
the Russian one said without thinking. She nodded. I'll be here. She scattered the last of the feed and folded the empty bag. When she rose from the bench, the park was brighter. The city was waking up. She walked home slowly, smiling to herself. Sleep might not come easily anymore, but mornings like this, full of love, made the waiting worthwhile. End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8. Florist. The call comes in 10 minutes before closing, which already puts the florist in a bad mood. Kate's halfway through sweeping petals off the floor, shoes kicked off behind the counter, mentally composing the text she is going to send her sister about dinner plans, when the shop phone rings. She considers letting it go to voicemail. She really does. Then she answers. Kate, from the Thorny Business, speaking? She says, professional by muscle memory alone. How can I help you? There's a pause, breathing. Then a deep voice, accented, energetic, like it belongs to someone who talks with their hands. Yes. Hello. I need flowers. Very important flowers. She straightens a little. Important flowers are her specialty. For when? She asks. Tomorrow morning, early, is for celebration. Congratulations? She prompts. Yes, he says enthusiastically. Very congratulations. She smiles despite herself. Great. What's the occasion? Another pause. Shorter this time. He won. Won what? He just won. The man repeats, as if that explains everything. She waits. There's a thoughtful hum on the other end of the line. Is big thing. Trophy. But I think you do not need details. Kate narrows her eyes at the receiver. You don't want anything themed? No sports things, he says quickly. Please, just flowers. Very good flowers. Okay, then. They move on to preferences. The man has a lot of them. He wants bold colors. Reds, definitely. Whites for contrast. Nothing too delicate. Nothing shy.
He is not shy,
the man explains, then corrects himself immediately.
Well, he is shy, but not like that.
She scribbles notes furiously. What about roses? She suggests.
Oh, yes, he says. Roses are good. Classic. Sexy.
Kate pauses. Sexy?
Yes,
he says. Like this is obvious.
This is sexy, congratulations.
She bites her lip to keep from laughing. Okay. And the card? Another pause. Longer. Suspicious.
I want message,
he says carefully.
But maybe you help?
She leans back against the counter. Already invested. Sure. Or what kind of tone?
Poem, he says immediately. But not sad poem. Like,
he struggles for the word.
Like teasing. Like flirting.
She raises an eyebrow. You want a flirty, congratulatory poem?
Yes. Exactly, like, very good.
Anything specific you want included?
Yes,
he says without hesitation.
That I am proud that he worked very hard. That he looks very good when he wins. And he adds, warming to the topic, that I cannot wait to celebrate with him later.
Celebrate how?
Kate asks before she can stop herself.
There's a beat.
Then a low, delighted laugh crackles through the phone.
You are funny,
he says, still laughing.
You already know.
She does know.
She absolutely knows. Kate glances around the empty shop, then lowers her voice conspiratorially. Okay, let's workshop. By the time they hang up, she has pages of notes and a grin she cannot wipe off her face. The final card reads, roses are red, violets are blue. You earned every cheer. I'm so proud of you. Enjoy all the praise, the trophies, the fame. Then come to my bed and let me remind you I'm the best. Kate rereads it 3 times. Then once more just for fun.
Oh, she says aloud to no one.
Oh, this is good. The order is extravagant, over the top. Too many roses. Exactly enough roses. She arranges them herself, adjusting stems until the bouquet looks like it's about to make a dramatic entrance somewhere. When she checks the delivery address, she pauses. It's not a house. It's not a hotel. It's a practice facility. She stares at the paper. Then she laughs.
Oh, she says again. Oh, this is even better.
Kate could hand it off to the delivery driver. She absolutely could. No one would blame her. But she's nosy. And this is too funny. So the next morning, Kate grabs her coat, lifts the bouquet carefully, and drives herself. The arena is quiet when she arrives, echoing in that way big spaces do, when everyone important has gone home. A receptionist points her down a hallway with a polite smile. He's in the locker room. The woman says, just knock. The florist knocks. A voice answers from inside.
Yeah?
She opens the door to find a man sitting on a bench, towel around his neck, hair damp. Face still flushed like adrenaline hasn't fully let him go yet. He looks up and immediately freezes.
Oh,
he says. Kate beams. Delivery for Shane? He stands too fast, knocking his legs into the bench.
That's me.
She hands him the bouquet. He takes it like it might explode.
They're beautiful,
he says automatically, then frowns.
Wait, who sent these?
She gestures delicately to the card. Why don't you read? He does. Color rises up his neck in real time. The florist watches it happen with professional fascination. Pink to red, to almost to purple. Really?
Oh my God,
he mutters. She bites her cheek. Is there a problem?
No,
he says immediately. No problem. Just... He glances up at her, mortified.
Did you read this?
Oh, she said cheerfully. Of course, I helped write it. He makes a noise that might be a prayer. Shane presses the card flat against his chest, like it might try to escape. He didn't have to do this. Kate laughs. Oh, he very much wanted to. Shane's phone buzzes in his hand. He looks at it, then at the flowers, then back at the phone. She steps back towards the door. Mission accomplished. Heart warm and mildly feral. As she leaves, She hears Shane answer his phone, voice softening immediately.
They are amazing, he says. You're ridiculous.
There's a pause.
Then Shane adds softly, I'll see you soon.
Kate closes the door quietly behind her, grinning all the way down the hallway. Some deliveries are worth doing yourself. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9. Make a Wish, Teenager. Author's notes. I hope this one won't be triggering to anyone. I try to stay very vague and avoid specific details about illness, as that can be difficult for some people. The hospital room smells like disinfectant and old coffee, the kind it's been sitting on a warmer since dawn. The teenager has been here long enough to know the rhythms of it. The nurse with the squeaky shoes, the doctor who always pauses before knocking, the way afternoons stretch thin, and strange when you're too tired to sleep but too wired to rest. When they tell him his make-a-wish is happening today, he assumes it'll be quick. A handshake, a photo, a practice smile, and a keep fighting, buddy, before the guy disappears back into the real world. Instead, Ilya Rozanov sits down. He actually sits on the edge of the bed, long legs folded awkwardly, elbows on his knees like he has nowhere else to be. He's taller than the photos, broader too, all sharp angles and restless energy contained just barely under the polite visitor version of himself. He smells faintly like cold air. So, Ilya says, glancing around the room, eyes catching on the poster taped crookedly to the wall. This is North Arena? Kyle snorts, despite himself.
Yeah, kinda missing the ice.
Ilya makes a face, dramatic and immediate.
Should add a small rink in the waiting room.
It's stupid, but it works. The kid laughs, a real one. And Ilya grins like he's won something important. They talk about hockey, obviously, about Boston, about captaining a team full of grown men who apparently can't remember to stretch unless someone yells at them. Ilya tells stories that feels improvised, jumping from topic to topic, hands moving constantly. He doesn't rush. That's the thing Kyle notices first. Ilya isn't checking the clock. He isn't glancing at the door. When a nurse pokes her head in and says she'll be back later, Ilya nods like this is exactly where he planned to be all afternoon. At some point, the conversation slows. Kyle's energy dips, like it always does. But he knows that this visit is special. Something he'll replay later when the room feels too quiet again. There's something he's been holding back. He says, staring very hard at the blanket. This will sound bad. Ilya perks up immediately.
I am excellent at bad.
The kid swallows. I mean, I really like you. You're great. But my favorite player is actually... He risks a glance up. Ilya is watching him closely, not smiling now, but not upset either. Just attentive. Shane Hollander. There's a beat. Then Ilya puts a hand over his heart and leans back like he's been shot.
Wow, he says. I come all this way, I sit on tiny bed, I tell my best jokes, and this is how you hurt me?
Kyle laughs, relieved, and apologizes immediately, words tripping over each other. Ilya waves it off, shaking his head, mock tragic.
No, no, it's fine. He is okay hockey player, I guess.
Okay? The teenager protests automatically. Ilya grins, sharp and fond in a way that doesn't quite match the teasing words. He looks down at his hands for a second, then back up, expression shifting into something conspiratorial.
Hey,
he says, lowering his voice.
You are good at keeping secrets?
Kyle nods, without thinking. Ilya reaches into his pocket and pulls out his phone. It's cracked at the corner, screen smudged with fingerprints. He holds it like it's something fragile.
Because, Ilya continues, glancing at the door even though they're alone. This is not for everyone.
He unlocks the phone and turns the screen slightly so the kid can see. The contact name at the top makes no sense at first. Jane. Ilya taps the video call button before the teenager can ask. It rings once, twice. Then the screen fills with a face Kyle recognizes instantly, even without the jersey, even without the eyes. Shane Hollander. Hair a little messy, eyes soft and familiar, in a way that feels too intimate for a public figure. He smiles when he sees Ilya, easy and automatic.
Hey, Ilya,
Shane says.
You done yet? Or are you still being charming?
Kyle freezes. Ilya laughs, bright and unguarded.
I'm always charming.
He turns the screen to face the teenager in bed.
I am with friend,
Ilya says, and there's something different in his voice now. Softer, real.
Hello,
Shane says, leaning closer to the camera, gaze flicking briefly, very briefly toward Ilya. I'm Shane, nice to meet you. They kept talking for a while, the three of them. Shane's smile widens, gentle and warm. And when he says Ilya's name, he says it on purpose, familiar and affectionate. Not Rozanov, never Rozanov. The kid doesn't need anything explained. It's all there, suddenly obvious. The way Ilya's shoulders relax, the way his mouth tilts when Shane talks. The way this call feels less like a favor and more like a check-in, like something that happens every day. Ilya ends the call after 10 minutes and tucks the phone away, like he's just put something precious back where it belongs.
Secret,
he reminds gently. Kyle nods, heart pounding, smiling so hard it almost hurts. Secret. Ilya stands then, careful, like he doesn't want to jostle anything. He squeezes the kid's shoulder, solid and reassuring.
You have very good taste, he says seriously. Do not tell him I said that.
When Ilya finally leaves, the room feels quieter, but not emptier. Kyle lies back against the pillows, staring at the ceiling, replaying the moment over and over. Later, when the nurse comes in and asks how the visit went, he just smiles and says, "It was really good." He doesn't mention Jane. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10. To a guide in Rome. Valentina, the tour guide, decides she likes them before she knows why. They are standing near the back of the group by the Trevi fountain, not taking selfies, not jostling for space, just watching. One tall, blonde, built like one of Bernini's angrier sculptures, keeps craning his neck, eyes bright, visibly vibrating with excitement. The other stays close, dark-haired, quieter, shoulders squared like he's guarding something precious without realizing it. He's very focused when he takes pictures. That's cute. She clocks them immediately as a unit. Rome teaches you this skill. You learn to read people fast. Honeymooners, history nerds, bored teenagers dragged along by parents. These two don't fit neatly anywhere, but they keep orbiting each other, gravity obvious even from a distance. "Okay, everyone," she says brightly, raising her voice over the water and the crowd. "This is the Trevi Fountain, completed in the 18th century. Though the aqueduct, it's connected to, dates all the way back to ancient Rome." They both come closer to listen to her. The tall one lets out a low, reverent wow. His companion smiles without looking at him. She talks about the ocean god, about abundance, about the tradition of tossing coins over your shoulder. As she speaks, she watches the tall one lean in, murmuring commentary under his breath, something about how Romans really understood drama. The dark-haired one nods, smirking. Later during the tour, Valentina mentions gladiators. "You always mention gladiators. Tourists love them." This type of thing makes the tall one light up fully. "Warriors," he says softly, almost to himself, accent thick and musical. "They fight together sometimes, like brothers." The other man hums in agreement. "Or partners." The guide pretends not to hear, but she absolutely does. She's already writing a story for them in her head by the time they walk toward the Pantheon. Maybe they met while traveling. Maybe one convinced the other to come. Maybe this is a celebration or an escape or just a rare pocket of time stolen from busy lives. Rome makes romantics of everyone, including professional narrators. At the Colosseum, the tall one is unbearable. In the best way, of course. He asks questions, gestures wildly, wants to know how the fighters trained, what weapons were favored, and whether they really fought to the death as often as people say. When she talks about endurance, about strength and spectacle, he listens like it's personal. "They were strong," he says, eyes tracing the ancient stone, "but also watched, always watched." The dark-haired man glances at him then, something quiet and knowing passing between them. She files that away. By the time they reach the Bocca della Verita, the sun is slanting low, the group tired but attentive. She gathers them in front of the ancient marble face, worn smooth by centuries of superstition and tourists braver than they look. "This," she announces, "is the mouth of truth. Legend says that if you put your hand inside and tell a lie, it will bite it off." A ripple of laughter moves through the group. Phones come out. She asks for volunteers. The tall blonde man steps forward immediately.
Wait, his companion says, catching his wrist gently. You don't even know what you're going to say. The tall one grins, wide and reckless.
I am very brave.
The guide smiles. Of course he is. He slides his hand into the stone mouth with exaggerated seriousness. The group quiets, waiting. The dark-haired man watches him with an expression so fond it nearly hurts to witness. The guide opens her mouth to prompt him, but the tall man leans in instead, lowering his voice. He doesn't project. He doesn't perform. He murmurs something meant for exactly one person.
I love you.
The dark-haired man's breath catches, just for a second. Then he smiles, soft and stunned and real. The hand comes back out intact. The group laughs, relieved. Someone catcalls. Someone else makes a joke about legends. But the guide doesn't laugh right away, because she saw it, the way it wasn't a joke, the way the words landed like a promise, like a truth tested and proven by stone older than both of them, the way the dark-haired man leaned in closer afterward, shoulder brushing shoulder, like the world had shifted and they were adjusting to the new center of gravity. As they walk away, she watches them fall back into step together. The tall one is still talking animatedly, comparing gladiators to modern athletes, to warriors of different kinds. The other listens, occasionally interrupting with dry comments that make the blonde one laugh too loudly. At one point, without thinking, they lace their fingers together. It's not a grand gesture. It's absent-minded, automatic. When the tour ends, she thanks everyone and wishes them a good evening. The couple lingers, tossing coins into the fountain like everyone else. The dark-haired one closes his eyes when he throws, murmuring something she doesn't catch. The other watches him like he's already home. Once again, the mouth of truth was right. She thinks. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11. Phone repair technician. The phone repair shop is narrow and loud, all buzzing lights and looping pop music, the air smelling faintly of heated plastic and dust. Oscar is halfway through reassembling a cracked Samsung when the door flies open hard enough to jingle the bell like it's being attacked. The guy who rushes in looks like he's come straight from a workout. Dark hair damp at the temples, hoodie half-zipped, eyes wide and laser-focused on the phone clenched in his hand. He doesn't stop. He doesn't look at the price board. "Hi," he says breathless, "I broke my phone." The repairman blinks.
"Okay.
I dropped it." The guy continues, words tripping over each other. "It slipped out of my hands, completely accidental, but it still works, I think. It just..." He turns the phone around to show the spider web crack blooming across the screen. "Does that?" Oscar takes it, turning it over with practiced ease.
"We can fix the screen."
"Are you sure?" The guy asks immediately. "Like, really sure?"
"Yes."
"Because I can't lose anything on it." The repairman nods, already reaching for a tool.
"We don't erase data for screen repairs."
The guy exhales, then immediately inhales again. Like that wasn't nearly enough reassurance. "Okay, but sorry, just to be clear, my photos stay?"
Yes.
And contacts?
Yes.
All the phone numbers?
Yes.
There's one number, the guy says, leaning closer to the counter, lowering his voice like he's about to confess to a crime. It's saved under Lily. I cannot lose Lily. Oscar pauses, looks up.
Your girlfriend?
The guy freezes. What? No. I mean, no. She's
important? Okay.
The repairman says carefully. Neutral. And, the guy adds, somehow more stressed. I just got a picture, like, right before I dropped it. The repairman's hands go still. He looks at the cracked screen, then back up at the guy's face, which has gone faintly pink. A picture, the guy repeats, nodding too fast. A very important picture. Private. The repairman has been doing this job for 11 years. He has seen wedding photos, cheating evidence, drunk selfies, feet pics, full-on affairs conducted exclusively via WhatsApp. He has learned not to ask follow-up questions unless absolutely necessary.
Okay,
he says again. The guy gestures helplessly. I don't want you to, you know, see it. Oscar raises an eyebrow.
I kind of have to turn the phone on.
The guy swallows. Right. Yeah, of course. Totally. That makes sense. If you do see it, could you... He stops, clearly realizing there is no dignified way to finish that sentence.
I won't comment on anything I see,
the repairman says, deadpan. The guy nods fervently. Great. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you. He doesn't leave. Instead, he stays planted at the counter, hands gripping the edge like the phone might try to escape. Oscar turns the screen on to test responsiveness, and the lock screen lights up instantly. The picture is unmistakable, pretty graphic, confident, the kind of photo that was meant for exactly one person and no one else. The repairman registers it in the same half second he's learned to process everything. Shape, lighting, context. Oh, okay. Moving on. The phone is nearly dropped again. This time, again, because of its owner. Oh my God, the guy says, lunging forward. I'm so sorry. I swear I don't usually... He stops himself, pressing his lips together, and physically turns his whole body away from the counter, mortified. The repairman locks the screen smoothly.
You're good.
The guy peeks back. You saw it.
Yes.
A beat.
But... Oscar adds, it's not the first dick pic I've ever seen.
The guy lets out a strangled laugh that turns into a groan.
Kill me. Take a seat,
the repairman says, nodding toward the chairs.
It'll be about 20 minutes.
The guy sits, like a runner waiting for the starting gun. He checks the time. He checks the door. He checks his empty hands, like he's surprised his phone isn't there. Every few minutes, he looks up.
It's still okay, right?
Yes.
My contacts?
Yes.
Lily?
Yes.
Oscar works efficiently, muscle memory guiding him through the process. He doesn't need to look at the phone much anymore. But when it lights up again during testing, there's a new notification banner at the top. Lily, you okay? You stopped replying. The guy notices at the same time and shoots to his feet. That's her? The repairman hums non-committally. She... The guy rubs a hand over his face. He worries. The repairman glances up, sharp enough to catch the correction. The guy doesn't seem to realize he's done it. He's pacing now, muttering under his breath in what sounds like sports terminology, maybe. When the phone is finally done, screen pristine and smooth, the repairman hands it over.
All set.
The guy takes it like it's sacred. He turns it on, swipes through photos, opens contacts, scrolls, relief washing over his face so clearly it's almost embarrassing to witness. Then his phone buzzes again. He smiles instantly, the stress evaporating like it was never there in the first place. Thank you, he says, earnest and warm, and a little sheepish. Seriously.
No problem.
After paying, the guy heads for the door, already typing a response with both thumbs. The bell jingles as the door closes. Oscar goes back to his next phone, shaking his head faintly. Some people really do carry their hearts in their pockets. End of chapter 11. I've just realized that I've gone beyond the 45-minute mark that I had set as a limit for myself for these individual audio files. But what to say, these stories are such delightful treats and they make me so greedy that I keep on wanting to reading and recording them. I'll be back soon with some more. Till then, thank you for listening. Hope you have a lovely day or night, wherever you are.